What is up? What is going on? You are ready for episode 3 of the threequel. This week we are talking the Valentine's Day classic, Silence of the Lambs. Everyone knew that this one would go down in history as one of the most romantic films of all time. Of course, we will see you on the other side of the song. Welcome back, everybody. Like I just said, episode 3 of the threequel. We only get to say that once. It works, but, you know, it will be gone and over with after this episode. I am one of your three hosts, Ethan Klein. I am here with Mike Duranik and Brad Miller. Gentlemen, welcome back once again.
Thanks, Ethan. Glad to be here.
You know, I can't think of anything that I would rather do than spend Valentine's evening with the two of you talking about, as you pointed out, just a romantic classic. Although I have to admit, you know, maybe not as romantic as you said that it was. You confused me, and it might have ruined date night last night, but I suppose that's on me for not pre-screening.
I was going to ask, I wonder how many people saw this on Valentine's Day as a mistake. In 1991. I mean, you know, like 91, like previews, obviously now, like you can go online and watch a preview dozens of times. Back then, that was definitely not the case. So how many people just kind of, you know, went to a theater, saw Jodie Foster's name, and it was Valentine's Day night. So they went and did not know what they were, that had to happen at a pretty high rate.
I mean, title alone might scare some people off. I don't know that, the title Silence of the Lambs would scream, you know, like romantic comedy or something. But yeah, I think a few probably stumbled in there looking for something to do.
Yeah, I think that it would have been an interesting date night had you accidentally ended up there. But I agree with Brad. Something in that title probably, although you never know, maybe you looked at it, lambs, everything, you know, nice and gentle. And you just thought, hey, you know, this will be a good way to set the mood. And you probably would have been very wrong, depending on what mood you were looking to set.
If this set a mood for someone, that is the key to run. If you leave the theater and your date is like, hey, you know, like, you want to head back to my place? Absolutely not. No, not after seeing this.
Or if your date said, let's go to the grocery store and get some fava beans and some Chianti.
Get a nice Chianti.
Might be the sign to run there too.
Also, after seeing this movie, I am never, ever going to help someone move a piece of furniture again. No matter how much it looks like they're struggling, they're just on their own. And I'm just going to have to live with the moral guilt of not helping someone in need because this movie ruined it for me.
Ethan's like, I'm sorry, Grandma. I can't help you move that. I'm sorry.
Got to go on principle right there, Brad. And I mean, you know, once you make a decision that moving furniture could lead to some catastrophic safety issues for you, you can't be too careful, even if it's grandma.
Well, we're just kind of making some casual jokes and comments about this movie. Let's just dive into it. So, of course, we are talking about the 1991 winner of many awards, which we will get into that at some point as well. Silence of the Lambs, Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins, the two big names on the bill there, directed by Jonathan Demme again, coming out on Valentine's Day, 1991. Gentlemen, let's start this as we always do. What was your guys' first experience with this movie?
Looking at the timeline, I really can't remember when I first saw it. I was 10 at the time that this came out. Pretty sure I didn't see it at 10 years old. Probably a few years later, you know, caught it on TV at my parents' house or something. Didn't go to the theater. I don't think I sought it out to rent it or anything like that. But our town library had a pretty good movie collection, and I'm guessing I probably grabbed it from there or something and watched it at home. But yeah, don't remember exactly, but somewhere probably 12, 13 years old is when I first saw it.
Yeah, for me, I was, I'm a few years younger than Brad, and so I can say with confidence I didn't see it in the theater at 4.5 going on 5. However, I can say, having looked for it in my movie collection, I was like, I know I have this movie, but I couldn't find it anywhere until I dug into the old archives of the VHS tapes where I found my handy dandy copy. And so, definitely at some point, watched it on VHS, and I'd guess probably mid to late mid 90s, probably in there would have been about the time that I would have caught it.
I actually did not see this for the first time until my sophomore year of college. So I was almost 20 years old, which, I mean, that would have been 25 years after the film came out. Just never saw it in high school. I don't know if I just didn't catch it when it was on TV. I hate commercials, so I quite often skipped watching things on TV. But then, finally on Netflix, knew that people had said a lot about it and watched it. And I don't know if you guys remember your opinion of the film prior to watching it this week for the podcast, but I definitely went into this with the most excitement that I had had so far in our short run here on the threequel because of the regard that I hold for this film, or that I held at least prior to this. Would you guys agree with that, or were you sitting in a little bit different camp?
I came from a different spot with it. I had to kind of force myself to sit down and watch it. It's not an easy rewatch. There are there's a lot of elements to it that are difficult to see, to hear, to understand. So, yeah, I had to kind of force myself to, where the other two, I was a little more excited to see it, but definitely glad to rewatch it. And I think my opinion now is probably different than before. So I'm sure we'll get into that later in the episode.
Yeah, I think I think that this is a great film, and at the same time, movies like this that are suspenseful, really kind of psychological thrillers, I've got to find myself in the right mood. And so I think that with this one, it was a situation where I kind of had to nudge myself a little bit more than the other two, but not because I necessarily like Old School or Footloose better. I certainly think that this is a higher quality film. It's just I would have to be in the right space to really want to watch it. And I think that this movie did that genre probably as well, if not better than most of the ones that followed. But similar to a movie like Seven or things like that, where you just got to be in the right space.
Seven was the movie I was going to bring up and compare it to. I've seen Seven more just because of how big of a Brad Pitt fan I am. And I just have more opportunities to see that movie. But exactly what you were saying, there are just so many parts of Seven or movies like that, especially this film, where just on a random Saturday night with friends, roommates, significant other, whatever, Silence of the Lambs probably not going to be at the top of the list to throw on and kick back and relax and watch. But we did watch it for this. This did give us that reason to do it. So let's dive in to the people who did make this film. And of course, like I said up at the top billing here, Jodie Foster, Anthony Hopkins. I also alluded to the awards that this film won. It won the Big Five. It won picture, director, lead actor, actress, and it won for its writing. And looking back on this is not a conversation we've had an opportunity to have because the first two episodes of the threequel, we didn't necessarily talk about Oscar contending films. But going back and seeing this, it is wildly impressive to me, the performances that they had. But I did look up the actual time, and Anthony Hopkins is only on screen in this movie for 24 and a half minutes and walked away with the lead actor Oscar. Surprising that he was named lead actor, but looking at his performance, I am not shocked because to me, I think this is a note perfect performance from him and draws you in completely.
Yeah, I think that he does fantastic, and we're going to get into it again later about things we liked about the movie and stuff like that. But that's actually I think a good point. Like, he does so well that it kind of dwarfs the other people in the movie in a lot of ways. And some of the things I really as I nitpick a little bit and dissect it, There are some things about his performance being so good that it took away from the movie in some ways, in my opinion. And like I said, we can get into that later. But I think, I don't know that, you know, 24 minutes in a movie should have got him an Oscar, especially because I believe he beat out De Niro in Cape Fear. And I think that that was probably more deserving. But yeah, I mean, I can't take away from the performance. He did a wonderful job with what he was given.
Yeah, I think it was a tour de force, right? And as a general rule, 24 minutes in a movie shouldn't get you a Best Actor Oscar. But this may be, you know, that exception to the rule, simply because he controlled the film so much, so well. It's really hard for me to imagine another performance of, you know, such a small amount of time on the screen where the movie was 100% carried by that person. And that's not to say there weren't excellent acting performances across this movie. There certainly were. They were just dwarfed by him. It's hard to imagine an actor at the peak of their powers more so than this in terms of commanding the screen for me.
Well, I mean, you said other performances that are great, and Jodie Foster did also win. And thinking back to the first couple times, I believe this is the third time I've seen this movie. And thinking back to the first couple times that I saw this, not that I disregarded her performance, but I really did try to focus, because we were going to do this podcast and be a little more analytical. I really did want to focus on her because I did not have the memories of those scenes. And I have to say that while the character, how larger than life they made him, how eccentric they made him, his character will live on. But I think she matches him note for note, especially in the scenes that they share, because the crazy thing is she had been acting for 14 years at this point. Taxi Driver was 14 years before this. And yet she still perfectly portrays someone who seems like this is, you know, their first outing of anything. And she does such a good job of having fear in all of her scenes, yet trying to convey the strength. And I think she acted note for note right along with him the entire time.
Well, we can get into it now if you want, or we can talk about it later. But I did not like her performance. I think that the element that she left out was the part that, like, she didn't make me care about her. Like, she didn't make me fear for her, or like, I was more compelled, and I feel like Lecter and Buffalo Bill were more likable as characters, and they're monsters, you know, like they're awful people, but yet, like, I was more enthralled by what was going to happen to them, and or you know, what's going to happen here and what's going to happen there. I just never felt like she did the one thing that would have made that part so much better. And that is, like, you want to be, I don't know, scared for her or rooting for her or whatever. And I feel like she just kind of went through it. And maybe that's part of what you were talking about. Like, she had to, she was scared to death, but had to be strong. And had, so maybe she chose in facing that part to leave out the part where you care for her or have empathy for her or whatever. But there was just, to me, something lacking there that just didn't make me feel for that character.
Yeah, I mean, Foster, she's an incredible actress, obviously, coming, you know, at this point, as you pointed out, 14 years into her career. But if I'm not mistaken, 3 years after she had won Best Actress the first time, right, in 88. And so certainly well established. I do agree with you, Ethan. She did a great job playing this in a way that, had you not known she had been around for a while and was extremely established, could have almost given the impression that she was newer to a film like this. She was able to play it with a freshness that I do think carried the day. However, Brad, something you said really made me kind of curious here, right? Was Hannibal Lecter in some way, shape, or form kind of the birth of the antihero? In the modern sense, obviously we're still 8-9 years short of when The Sopranos takes over on HBO and all that stuff with the television thing. But you saying that you were, you know, rooting for him through this entire thing, and I certainly was as well, far more than rooting for Clarice. just something I wanted to throw out your guys' way. Curious what you think.
Yeah, I think the scene that where you really where I realize it is like those officers go into the cage that he's in, and in some ways you're like, but you know, where I should be thinking like, come on guys, get out of there, or please someone stop him or whatever. It's like, well, let's see what he does here. Like, these guys are bumbling idiots if they're going to walk in there like that. Maybe, you know, if he's smart enough to get them to do those things, let's see where he takes this. And like, at no point am I rooting for the good guys in that scene. And then there's some other things there too. And even with the Buffalo Bill stuff, like, you know, I didn't want him to hurt the girl in the well or the pit or whatever that is in that house. But at the same time, it was an entertaining character that made me have an emotion towards him, whether it was, you know, good or bad, at least I cared. And I think that's the part that was lacking with Jodie Foster. And part of it is I'm probably just a little biased. I'm not a huge Jodie Foster fan. And the other part is too, in doing a little research on this, I saw that Michelle Pfeiffer was supposed to get that part. And that was kind of like a glass breaking moment for me, because I could see Michelle Pfeiffer doing what I thought I wanted Jodie Foster to do, and that's getting you to really care about that character. She wouldn't have been able to pull off the FBI agent part, I think, as much as Jodie Foster did. But as far as like getting you to care about her well-being and what happens to her and rooting for her and stuff, I think that Michelle Pfeiffer might have done a better job.
Yeah, I think that in terms of what Mike brought up, I think the thing that they did so well with Hannibal Lecter's character that makes the legend of it last so long. I mean, for someone like me, again, I didn't see this till I was almost 20 years old. I didn't know going into it the Buffalo Bill storyline. I thought that Silence of the Lambs was Jodie Foster trying to catch Hannibal Lecter. So that's the legend that has lived on long past this movie, that he is, in just 24 minutes of screen time, such an influential character. And I think some of the things they do so well is the stuff with the doctor, Dr. Chilton, because there's a separate storyline happening outside of Clarice and Buffalo Bill. And it is the storyline of this guy who is an absolute creep. I mean, the way he's hitting on Clarice when she gets there, and then he's really rude to her. They allude to the fact that he probably does more torturing of the patients at the mental hospital than he does actually treating them. It's all his fault. Lecter escaping really has nothing to do with him helping Clarice. It has everything to do with the hubris of Dr. Chilton, because he tries to worm his way into the situation, and it sets this whole thing up. And so we're given so many reasons to hate the people that are around Lecter that you're able to just focus on how charismatic Anthony Hopkins is. And it does create, like Mike said, that sort of anti-hero thing, because at the end of the day, if he doesn't give Clarice the note in her file, she never finds Buffalo Bill. So he really did help solve the case. And we never see him be brutal and violent until that escape scene. I thought that was one thing that I noticed that I thought they did really well. When Chilton is trying to scare Clarice and say, this is what happened, you know, he tells the story about him biting the nurse. We see her see the picture. We never see the picture. So we're not given any images of how terrible Hannibal Lecter is. It's all legend. They just constantly build this legend, and then we just see the person. And I think that gave a lot of opportunity for why Brad said he's more enthralled with that character. And like Mike said, the legend and the anti-hero thing, because we don't really see him be brutal until really the biggest action scene of the movie.
Yeah, I think, you know, in fact, you almost see him in the light of why are they so bent out of shape about this guy, right? I mean, he's kind of a jerk, and he's toying with her through the whole thing. But, you know, when she gets some stuff thrown at her earlier in the film, he's the one who says, yeah, that's inappropriate, right? He comes almost to the rescue there. He does help along the way. He does help move the investigation forward. And so I think you put it really well. It's the building up of that legend, which crescendos into that scene. And I found myself, like you said, Brad, in that scene, I remember distinctly the first time watching it, the suspense of it, but I was definitely not, it wasn't like, you know, your typical horror movie thing where you're saying to the heroes, get out, get out. No, you were like, okay, let's see where this goes. And even this time watching it, you're almost rooting for Lecter in that situation. Like, yeah, go get away.
Yeah. The thing, the inmate that throws the stuff at her, I don't remember his name, but the fact that Miggs. Basically Lecter.
Yes. Miggs.
Basically the fact that Lecter is so smart and such a good talker that he talked this guy into killing himself is basically what happens. And at no point when we hear this, I'm not going to speak for you guys, but I wasn't like, oh, okay, killer being bad. I mean, we saw what Miggs did to her. We're like, yeah, guy probably deserved that. But again, it just adds to the legend. We don't see what he did. We don't know how he did it. We just hear, well, we know Lecter was whispering something to him, and a couple hours later, he was dead. And so it just keeps adding to that.
So I've got to give credit where credit is due. So shout out to Bill Simmons and his Rewatchables podcast. But they did an episode on Silence of the Lambs. And I did not research this, but Bill said he did, and that he found out you cannot kill yourself by swallowing your own tongue unless...
That seemed a little weird.
Unless you cut your own tongue off first and then choke on it as you're trying to eat it. And also, like, you know, what could he have possibly said to make this guy think, you know what would be better than this? Swallowing my own tongue. And then something you said too, Ethan, kind of made me smile. We're made to believe that Miggs, who grossly throws bodily fluid at Clarice, deserves to die, yet the Hannibal, or the cannibal, we're right. rooting for, and this guy eats people, you know, like, great job, Anthony Hopkins, yeah. to get us to like this guy, you know?
And that comes back to, again, 24 minutes, and De Niro and Cape Fear, incredible, but that's how good this performance is. I think about what you just said. He has you wrapped around your finger rooting for him through the entire thing, and then at the end of it, you're like, wait a minute. And so hence the anti-hero thing of you're rooting for him the whole time. It's like, you know, it's like rooting for Walter White. And you're like, wait, why am I rooting for a meth kingpin again? Just so effectively done.
And I think that's exactly why this movie won the awards that it won and has lived on the way that it has. I've seen Cape Fear once. It's a well-acted film. It's a good film. I'll probably never watch it again because it's an hour and 45 minutes of Robert De Niro being as evil as humanly possible, disgustingly evil. At no point, even like when he fights off those guys that get sent after him, I'm not cheering for him. I'm hoping they succeed and they don't. And then in the final 15 minutes, he gets what he deserves for being the antagonist of the film. Versus this, we end up rooting for the antagonist of the film because of these little things that they do and the way they do that. So I think that's why this movie lives on at legend status past something like a Cape Fear. That is a really good film, but there's just that extra piece that got put in to Hannibal and to this character. And you're looking now, if you know, you guys are listening to this the day of the second episode, but there's a new show on CBS that just started last week, Clarice. So they're still trying to feed into this legend now, 30 years later. Wow, this movie's 30 years old today. I just realized that. Okay, so let's keep walking through this here. Brad, did you have anything with the, there was only one song in this movie. If we want to transition into music, this one's a little bit different, obviously, than the first two that we've watched. There was one song that stuck out to me in this movie.
Yeah, maybe that's a better way of saying it. There's one song that sticks out. There are a few songs that are played in the movie. The three that I'm going to talk about, obviously you have American Girl by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers that really kind of they used to just embody who that character is that he's that Buffalo Bill is pursuing. That is one. The one though that really stands out to me, because when you hear it, it just automatically, at least when I hear it, if I ever do outside of this, it takes me back to the scene, and that is Goodbye Horses by Q Lazarus, that is playing while Buffalo Bill is doing his trans dance, I guess you could call it. And then Rock of Ages is played on the organ at the funeral, which is another very popular song. But there's a few other songs in the film that are just kind of, you know, mostly background noise. But the score for it is fantastic. And I think the music that they use to set the suspense and things is just done really, really well. So great job there by the director in using those musical pieces to really heighten the mood of some of those scenes.
Yeah, I think just American Girl, because you know as soon as you see her, at least on a rewatch, obviously, that she is the girl that's about to get kidnapped. And that song is so catchy, and it's such a fun song. And she's jamming out in her car to it. And then it's not even Buffalo Bill that pulls up behind her, because he's already in her parking lot. But as soon as I see the two headlights behind her, it just changes my mood of the scene. So I think they just that scene is done so perfectly well. And when you're talking about a guy who won Best Director in this year, it's those things like that. It's the things we talked about, the legend building, but just those small scenes like that too, the framing of her and who she is and what's about to happen. And then even the kidnapping itself, you know, him having the bomb arm, the way he goes about that. And I mean, too, to give credit to Ted Levine, I always knew him growing up as the cop on Monk, you know, just more of a funny comedic guy. And this is, no pun intended, but I can't think of a better word, a transformative performance that he is not himself. He is this character fully and completely for this entire movie.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It definitely into the character, and it's hard to see him in another role and think of this or vice versa.
Yeah, it's one of those that just sticks with him. Anytime you hear him speak now in any role, it just harkens back to Buffalo Bill, and it's just, you know, that voice and in the scenes. I mean, he's really got like five or six lines that he speaks like that in this film, because he speaks pretty normal and, you know, in a lower tone when he's upstairs with Clarice. But very iconic lines, and it really just, it shows how awesome he did with this performance, that you can take five lines and be recognized that for your entire career.
How did you guys feel about the way that he met his demise?
The part that bothered me as I'm rewatching it, and I don't know how difficult it is to film, and make it look, you know, like night vision or something like that. But like, I have no idea how she turned and got those shots off, where he can see her. He's already got the gun on her and cocked, and somehow she hears it, spins, can't see anything, and still is able to shoot and kill him before he gets her. So that part, I don't know why it kind of stumbles through the way it does, or if maybe he just, you know, he didn't want to kill her, so he was trying to somehow take her down without killing her. I don't know, but yeah, definitely some stumbling through those scenes there at that kind of bothered me.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that it doesn't play the best unless you infer something like Brad said, that he was trying to take her alive or something of that nature, in which case, you know, you'd have some questions about why he approached it the way that he did. So I suppose that either you have to infer or you take the next step and just say, hey, it was a very lucky shot on her part, and it comes down to that.
Yeah, I guess to me it felt like they've put so much focus on the Clarice and Hannibal Lecter relationship, which is the point of this movie. I mean, the point of this film is that relationship. It truly is. Buffalo Bill does become somewhat of a side story to that overall story. And they happen to also hit that out of the park with Ted Levine's performance. It just felt like they got down to the very last moment and didn't know. They had a really good idea, which that scene holds up for me. The night vision, him almost touching her hair, but not, that is still as creepy as it was the first time I saw it, not knowing how it was going to end. It, and I think just kind of with you guys too, it just felt a little lackluster that the way this guy, how surgical he was, how good he was at not getting caught, it comes down to she just kind of turns, falls, and gets him. That's probably the only thing that I come away with on the rewatch where I was like, that doesn't hold up 30 years later. But we've had those moments in all of these movies so far, I think, what we're running into. And oddly enough, you know, we talked about the things that we had in Old School that would not get made or put into a film today or said today. There was the couple scenes from Footloose where we agreed. This is, to me, this is the first movie that if this movie, exactly how it is, got released today, I don't know. I think they could just release it exactly how it was today. And I don't know if it would be met with some of the issues that the first two movies would have based on some key scenes. Would you guys agree or disagree with that?
I think that out of sensitivity to the LGBTQ community, I think that they would probably tone down some of the transvestite stuff because it kind of comes across like you have to be severely mentally ill to be that way. So I think that there would have to be some explaining to do or some another way to tackle that character that would play within that community. I think there'd be a lot of backlash because, I mean, in some instances it'd be like, you know, if they were going to show him as a Christian person that also has these issues, like the Christian community would be like, why does the Christian have to have the, you know, be the serial killer? And I think that, you know, they'd have to explain, why does the serial killer have to be transvestite as well? You know, like there would be a little bit of that just because of the sensitivity of the, or the nature of the subject. But I think overall, I think you're right for the most part, Ethan, that this would be the most likely to just be released as is and be acceptable. And looking at Mike there, I think there's some stuff you want to kind of piggyback off that.
Well, yeah, you hit exactly where I was going with it. I think the Buffalo Bill character would have to be reimagined in a different way. You know, understandably, in 30 years, thank goodness our society has moved forward in the way that we try to be cognizant of how we portray things and the potential damage it can do. The one thing that I do think would be important if this movie was released today, and again, this would be a shout out to not necessarily Bill Simmons podcast, but to an article that they ran on The Ringer in the last couple of weeks. For movies like this to work, they almost have to be set back before cell phones. And that's one of the things that I do think, you know, this movie couldn't be released in the year 2021. There would have had to be major reworks on that because if Clarice is walking around with a cell phone, you know, if technology being what it is, it's an entirely different ball game than what you have here. And so I do think it could be released, but it would have to be like back then from that standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair. Did you guys catch the line while we're on the subject of the Buffalo Bills character and what's going on? Did you guys catch the part where Hannibal Lecter said that he's actually not transgender?
Yeah, there is a line in there where Lecter references that. And again, it is a part of his almost psychological profile of who this person is.
It threw me. I don't know. It threw me. And they never went back to it. I don't know what they were really trying to infer with that. It was when, like you said, Mike, he was getting, I just didn't know if that guy stuck out, if that stuck out to you guys or if you had any thoughts on that. Because it seemed like something that they could have dove into, and maybe nowadays they would have to dive into that part more, like Brad was saying, to be more sensitive. But I don't know. It was just something that did stand out to me, and they never really went back to it.
Well, the way that I interpreted it, and as I was reading on the movie, I can't remember where exactly I saw this, but I do think that part of the reason for that line was to try to not not blur, you know, LGBTQ and this particular character as one. It was to say, look, whatever's going on with this character, clearly a lot is not well with him emotionally, mentally. There's severe mental illness. He's killing people, right?
Right.
And so I think that what the purpose of that line was, if I'm not mistaken, was to kind of differentiate that and to make it clear that what Buffalo Bill's issues were his alone.
That would make sense. I can see that. All right, we started to have the conversation of today versus 1991. And of course, if you've listened to the first couple episodes of the threequel, we do this every week. We want to check out the world that this movie did come out in. So 1991 is not a year we've broached yet. We're getting into a new decade here in the 90s. You guys have a lot more experience in the 90s than I do. I don't remember most of the time I spent in the 90s. Some maybe, but not a lot. So let's have a conversation about the world that this movie came out in, 1991.
Yeah, so if you...
The greatest decade ever, right, Brad?
The greatest decade
ever. I don't know that I agree with that, but I haven't given it much thought, so we'll have to come back to that some other time. But yeah, a few of the things that we like to hit as I was kind of looking at some things from 1991, you know, there's a couple of deaths that year. One that really stood out, I think that stood out the most to me, was Dr. Seuss passed away that year. The one I found the most interesting, and I would have lost a bet definitely if you asked me the timeline of this, but the World Wide Web was launched to the public in 1991. I would have guessed much later. I know I'm from the Midwest in a small town, and I don't really remember much of the web until probably more like 95, 96, 97, somewhere in there. So I would have had no idea in 1991 what anyone was talking about when they mentioned that. Another one that stood out to me that was surprising. So apparently Kentucky Fried Chicken legally changed their name to KFC. And I just always thought that we just called it KFC. I still thought it was Kentucky Fried Chicken, but the actual name of the restaurant is KFC now. Did you guys know that was a thing?
I've only ever known it as KFC, but maybe that's one of the first ever public trends, you know, get something trending. I mean, without Twitter, but they heard enough people saying it and they decided to run with it.
Yeah, I think I might have known that somewhere in the deep recesses of my mind, but I'm not sure that if you had asked me that I would have said, "Oh yeah, well it was a legal change."
Brad, you mentioned the World Wide Web getting released. I thought that something that really it popped out to me when they said it. When Clarice and the other Asian are looking at the map, they're talking about the randomness or apparent randomness of the bodies being found. And she says, there can't be a pattern. The computer would have caught it. And I feel like in 1991, I don't know if the computers would have caught it. Like, did they have that in 91?
Well, I would think for the right. FBI, probably, especially okay. if they were releasing the World Wide Web in 91 to the general public, you got to figure, with that being a governmental thing, by that point they were ahead of the game.
Yeah.
Or they wanted us to think that they were ahead of the game.
Right. Throw this line in there, and then if anybody's thinking about becoming a serial killer, they just won't do it.
A couple other fun facts: salsa outsold ketchup for the first time in 1991. Have no idea why that would have changed then, but I thought that was interesting. 60 Minutes was the most popular TV show. Terminator 2 Judgment Day was the highest grossing film that year. 1991, the New York Giants were Super Bowl champs. That is the year of the missed field goal there by Buffalo. Minnesota Twins won the World Series, and the Pittsburgh Penguins were the Stanley Cup champions. Chuck Knoll retired as the head coach of the Steelers. He was a staple through my childhood in the NFL, so that was a pretty big deal. Some of the other popular TV shows that year, Roseanne, Murphy Brown, Cheers, Home Improvement, any of those show staples for you guys as children?
I watched Home Improvement as a kid, just like reruns, obviously, but I remember it being on. I did watch through Cheers post college, once it was on Netflix. So I do enjoy that. I do know it, but obviously not in 1991. You mentioned Terminator 2. It's crazy. They just put the movie Backdraft. I don't know if either of you guys are fans of that cult classic. But I watched it the other day on HBO, and I was watching it and I was like, how in the world did this movie not win visual effects? There is absolutely no way that anything would have beaten this movie for visual effects. And so I looked it up, and Terminator 2 came out the same year. And I said, oh, that's why Backdraft did not win visual effects. But that one always, it's always a fun watch for me. I don't know if you guys enjoy that one, but probably not something we'll do on this podcast. But
Right. Our president that year, George H.W. Bush, Dan Quayle, vice president. Shout out Dan Quayle from Indiana there. Average price of gas in 1991, $1.14, a stamp, 29 cents. And I don't know what it is today. I did not do the research, but Americans paid on average $15,473 for a new car. I wish we could go back to those days. That would be very, very nice. Was there anything else that you guys kind of came up with for 1991? I've got a few more things I can touch on, but wanted to see if you guys had anything else.
Well, this year is pretty obvious. I know Mike has a Michael Jordan factoid for us.
Well, you know, again, in keeping with every movie has to connect there, this was the Bulls' mm-hmm. first NBA championship, beating the Los Angeles Lakers 4-1. They lost game one. And then they ran the table, won it all. Also, this is the year that Magic Johnson announced in November of this year that he had HIV and was retiring from the NBA. And so it was a big year in a lot of ways with that, and certainly a huge seismic shift in the NBA, the end of one guard and the coming of the next guard.
So since you guys, I'm sure, know this better than I do, did he retire on the spot when he announced it?
He did. He retired, and then he but Magic, you know, it was an interesting thing. He ended up voted into the All-Star game year.
I was trying to remember when that happened with him and Michael.
Because he retired in November of 91, if I'm not mistaken, and the ballots had already been printed, and so he was on the ballot. The fans voted him in. He played that game in, you know, February, it probably would have been, of 1992. But then stayed retired until 1996. He unretired for a half of a year or a little less and played for the Lakers again.
The days where, well, the ballots were already printed. Yeah. So.
Interestingly enough, he was also married that year. And I don't remember the timeline of how all those things took place, but it was earlier in 91 he got married, and then obviously later the news came out and made those announcements. So normally we touch on the top five highest grossing films. We mentioned Terminator 2, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves was 2, Beauty and the Beast 3, our show now, Silence of the Lambs, number 4, and the, you know, probably best Oscar movie of the year that really got overshadowed by Silence of the Lambs, City Slickers, came in at number 5.
Oh. Yeah.
So yeah, those were my fun facts from 1991. Yeah, anything else that you gentlemen want to talk about from 1991?
That hit everything that I knew was going to get brought up. I was saving the salsa.
Oh, one last shout out for Mr. Duranik here. The top male baby name for 1991 was Michael.
There you go. All right. So let's shift gears back to Silence of the Lambs. We'll wrap up our third episode here of the threequel. We got a couple things we got to talk about. Do a little trivia question for you guys, and then we'll talk about next week's film. So we always do favorite line, favorite scene. Let's start with favorite line, gentlemen, whoever would like to go first. What was your favorite line from Silence of the Lambs? This seems like it will be a slightly different conversation than we've had the first
two. It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again. I mean, come on, how can you not go with that? Like, it's hilarious and creepy at the same time.
That makes me squirm so much worse than the fava beans and the Chianti. And I know that has lasted, but him saying that, physically, I was like shivering as he was saying that when I watched
it makes me laugh and gives me like goosebumps at the same time. Like, because you know, like what this guy's capable of doing and what he really means by that line, you know, and what horrible things he's done to her and other people. But the way he delivers it and then the voice and, you know, just the whole thing with the dog. And it's kind of silly, unintentionally funny. We talk about that a lot on this show. It's definitely unintentionally funny. But yeah, that's my line.
I can't hear that line and not think of the South Park episode where Cartman is in the basement playing lambs. So there's your pop culture merger. For me, it would be having an old friend for
That's
dinner.
That's also great.
So just a mic drop at the end of the movie right there.
And again, I don't feel remorse for Chilton when that happens. To me, that's a great capper on the end of this movie. And I don't like Chilton, and I don't care about what's about to happen to him because of the legend that they've built up. And that line...
Well,
encapsulates
that
it
goes
perfectly.
Back to the whole thing. Like, I don't know why. Like, this guy is a jerk. He's a womanizer. He's abused, criminals or patients or whatever you want to call the people that he deals with, and yet we're rooting for him to be eaten by a cannibal. Like, it's crazy how at the end you're like, oh yeah, he deserves that. That makes sense. And we're like, you know, don't get caught. Don't get caught, Hannibal. Go get him. It's just so interesting. You know, I don't know how they do that, but they pull us in every time.
I meant to ask this earlier. We can make it quick here. Do you guys think that Lecter has like sexual or romantic feelings towards Clarice?
I didn't interpret it that way, at least. I think that it is an intellectual attraction and really psychological on that level.
So I'm going to use that question to get into some of the things I did not like about this movie, because I think they go hand in hand. So the things that stand out to me, first off, like as a... They called it a horror film in the awards circuit, you know. I don't think it was a horror film. I think it was more suspenseful. But to me, they don't do a good enough job of pulling out and dragging out the suspense. Like, and the things that really stood out to me, and it starts with his relationship with Clarice. They say, you know, they kind of infer he doesn't talk much. He hasn't talked much in years. He hasn't seen a woman in years. And you expect, like, when she gets there, that she's going to have to, like, you know, really lean into him to get him to open up and talk. And, like, she goes down the hallway there and she gets to his cell and he's just standing there like he's going to welcome her to a dinner party or something. He's like, you know, good evening or whatever he says to her. And, like, the things that don't make sense to me, and I think it was because they were trying to make it neat and tidy and short, you know, under 2 hours. I think they really wanted to get in there under 2 hours. And they just don't spend a lot of time with that intellectual back and forth. You know, I think a lot more time could have been spent with her, you know, digging and dissecting and him doing that and then bouncing off each other. But, like, he gives her information way too quickly, way too easily. Doesn't really make her work for it. Doesn't really make her, you know, spell out her credentials and things like that. And I think part of that is what Mike said, an intellectual attraction that he has to her. Maybe he sees something in her that he can help unlock or bring out later. I have no idea. But the thing that bothered me about rewatching it was, why is he giving her this information? What did she do to deserve it? Other than, you know, he's got an end game in mind that maybe he sees an angle where he's going to use this to get out later. Like, I have no idea, but that's the problem. Like, they should have spelled that out better. It's like, why did she deserve this? How does he know she's that smart? How does he know that this is the person that he wants to have these interactions with? It all happened way too quickly. And I think it goes back to Ethan's question there. It's like, what was it about her that got him to open up this way and to feed these answers and feed that stuff? So I guess I want to see what you guys thought on that. But that part of the movie really just kind of bothered me. It's like, this was way too easy for her and for the FBI with how smart Lecter is supposed to be.
Well, I will give my answer to that while also saying my favorite line, because I think they go hand in hand. My favorite line from the film happens in that first meeting between the two of them. And he asks her why she thinks that Buffalo Bill removes the skin. And he's being elitist in a way by asking the question. He's asking it as though, you know, numerous people have come and tried to get inside of his mind and it's never going to work. So there's nothing that especially this young FBI agent who doesn't even have a true badge can do. And she says it excites him. Most serial killers keep some sort of trophies of their victims. He responds, I didn't. And she says, no, you ate yours. And there's a moment that he doesn't go back with a quip. He just pauses and looks at her. And to me, it felt like in that moment, the fact that she was able to come up with that on the spot, the fact that she didn't back down from his question, even though he asked it in a disrespectful way, there was this instant respect that she gained right there by being willing to throw a jab back at him. Because to me, it seemed like every single person that's interacted with him is either completely afraid of him, so it's not a mental workout for him because they're afraid, or there's someone like Chilton who just assumes that he's crazy, and so they're not going to give him an actual true intellectual conversation. And I think she hits that all in that one line, and that's why it was my favorite line. So that to me is why I understand what you're saying. And like you said, you know, they didn't want to have a 3-hour movie, but there were those little moments like that that I think I could see him accepting that she was not going to back down.
Yeah, and I think there was probably that part also, Brad, that he did see an angle. And I think that they alluded to that with some of the demands or the different requests that he had over the course of it. And so maybe somewhere in between seeing an angle with her that he could put himself in an advantageous situation to stage a breakout, coupled with that psychological kind of attraction, that may be the reason there. But I can see the critique in the sense that it does require some inferring to kind of jump to get there.
Part of the problem is to pull back the curtain a little bit, I've spent a lot of time recently watching Sherlock on BBC, and like Sherlock is the only character I've ever seen where you just kind of widely accept that he's going to get the answer right away, and it's going to be some small little detail that gives him the answer, and you kind of accept that as how it's going to be. And with her, it's like, he makes one line about, yourself or something like that, and she somehow figures out it's a storage unit outside of Baltimore, and then she figures out the anagrams right away. Like, I just wish they would have spent a few more minutes showing her, like, stressing over this and analyzing it and just taking a few minutes to figure it out, rather than it just seeming like, oh, yeah, that doesn't make sense. This is a clue, and here's the answer. And they just jumped to it a little too quickly for my taste, but still a good film. I think that's just me not remembering it quite, flowing quite so quickly, and really just wishing there was a little bit more backstory within the dialogue there.
Well, it is interesting that, I mean, there's a lot of scenes where you notice, I mean, they're definitely pushing forward that as a woman, she is going to to be treated and looked at differently. Obviously, Dr. Chilton coming on to her, there's scenes of her out on the course running and guys are running by and taking a second glance and checking her out. There's insinuations made about her throughout the whole movie. All of that aside, there is no absolute way that her character would have ever been put in this position. She's mentally unstable. I mean, the fact she almost walks in on a funeral that is of a victim of a crime that she's investigating because she's imagining that it's her father. And even though Crawford tells her not to give any information to Lecter that's real, she proves that she has the ability to lie to him. She creates the whole plea deal for him, and it's completely false, and she sells that. But then she's willing to tell him the truth about her father. So there are a lot of things about her as a person that would not have allowed her to succeed in this situation that I found interesting.
See, that's this where, time through watching it. I pulled out a little something different there. I felt like she was probably as mentally stable as could be when she was given that assignment. And what you're seeing throughout the film is Lecter breaking her down and pulling some of this stuff out of her. But that's the problem. They don't spend enough time with that dialogue to really show that happening. So you have to infer that. You have to assume, okay, she's struggling now through this because of things he's saying to her and things he's doing. But it's just the way it's done. I think it in some ways seems it's like it's lazily portrayed and that we're just supposed to kind of assume that she's going through this now because he's got that kind of intellectual hold on her. I wish there was more to the conversations and the relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, that's fair. And that's a really good point. I didn't look at it that way, but that does make a lot of sense. So we've heard our favorite lines. Let's transition into favorite scene. I'll kick it off. I'm sure there's a chance, maybe all three of us have the same favorite scene. It's the breakout scene for me. I mean, just because, and like I said, they do such a good job this whole time. We don't see any photos of any crime he's committed. Everything we hear about him is legend. It's hearsay. It's a story of a story. And all of a sudden, in one moment, he is the monster that has been portrayed and somehow even tops it. I mean, how surgical he is, getting the cuffs off, cuffing the other cop, disposing of the one so that he can focus on the other and then go back. And the way that he escapes, the planning that goes into that, sending the elevator up to bring it back down. On a first time seeing it, I had no idea what was going to happen. I remember distinctly the first time I saw it, I would never have guessed that he was wearing that face. How horrific that is, how just unnerving that thought is. That scene is played out perfectly. That scene is executed perfectly all the way up to the end when he sits up and pulls the face off. I mean, that I will never forget the first time I saw that, him just ripping that face off. That will always be in my mind. So that's my favorite scene. Where are you guys at? I think
that that sequence is probably, probably definitely, but definitely the best part of the film. There's probably about a 20 minute sequence of events there that really unfold. But I think the thing for me that is my favorite is, you know, I think where he sits up in the ambulance and he takes the mask, and I guess there's like some hair and stuff on there too that he pulls off, and he you know, it's just such a end to that wild sequence there that just it really just kind of stands out, like, wow, this guy pulls this off, nobody notices. How does he outsmart this entire group of people to get to this moment? And it just also shows the level of psychopathy that we're dealing with in a character like that. Just a really well done sequence that kind of crescendos in that ambulance scene.
Yeah, I agree. I think that I'll just shout out an honorable mention to the scene with Clarice in James Gunn's home up until the end of it, as we talked about the issues with the end of that scene. But the suspense in that scene, because we know, and obviously she doesn't initially, and then seeing her figure out where she is, who he is, and all of that, definitely it would be a close 1B for me in terms of the suspense of that.
Agreed. Agreed. Let's put a wrap on it, guys. Brad, I mean, we have given some, we have that extensive conversation there, but the way we end all of these is, do we give it our stamp of approval? If someone comes up to you and says, "Hey, I haven't seen this. I want to give it a try for the first time." What is your official recommendation going to be? Brad, I don't know where you're going to go with it. Because you've had probably more issues with this one than any of us have had with any movie. So Brad, where you go?
Would say that, of course, I can't not give a stamp of approval to an Oscar winning film. I mean, it won 5 Oscars that year. And I can't even begin to say that my opinion of something would say that I shouldn't give it approval. I would say this though. I think in the last 30 years, they figured out how to do this better, tell this story better, with more, less inferring of details and figuring out subtle ways to put things in. So I would say absolutely watch it. Everyone needs to see this movie, because it is very important to, you know, kind of setting the stage for the next 30 years of movies like this. But I would say, don't go into it expecting, maybe some things that you've seen that are really, really well done lately. Because I think they've figured out how to do this better. Now I think of things like, help me out, Ethan. What's that HBO show True Detective, you know, like taking if this had been a
True Detective, yeah,
a series of episodes like True Detective, and they really were able to spend time pulling out the psychological angles of it, I think Silence of the Lambs would blow that out of the water. But because it's a 2-hour film, and they have to rush through some of that, I think there is some things that are lacking. So I've seen things done better, but absolutely watch the film. Would get my stamp of approval.
Yeah, I think at a minimum, watch the film, because again of Hopkins' performance and just how commanding it is. Although I do think in some ways his performance probably ruined the source material, and we've seen so many different ways and times that they've tried, you know, to bring it back in movies, in television, even presently. And while some are better than others, none of them quite live up to this, because he was just on a whole different level. I would highly recommend it from that standpoint, just because I do think it's one of the great acting performances of that period of time.
Yeah, so it's going to get the 3 out of 3. We have yet to find a movie that doesn't get the 3 stamps of approval. And I would say, just to piggyback with that, I'm going to be confident and say that no actor has done in 25 minutes of screen time of a movie that I've seen that Anthony Hopkins does in this film, the way that it has lived on, the legend of it in that. And I think, Brad, I agree with your point of True Detective and what we've seen. I think what they do perfectly in this film that definitely is not done now today, 30 years later, is how often they allow our imagination to make up for just unnecessary violence. You know, we don't see what he does to the people in the ambulance. They let us imagine what that could have been. We don't see that guy's face. In a movie today, we would have watched him cut that guy's face off. We only see him when he is beating up that guard. We would have seen that. So they rely so much on our imagination to create the horror. And I think that, above anything else, definitely stands the test of time 30 years later. So it gets the stamp, 3 stamps out of 3. Go check this one out. Trivia question for you guys. Here we go. Can you name the film or the actor that portrayed the Hannibal Lecter character that came out before Silence of the Lambs?
I want to say it's something like Midnight Runner or something like that. I can't really remember, but that something like that jumps to mind.
Yeah, I read this when I was doing the research before this, but I'm drawing a blank right now. Midnight sounds right, though. Is that close?
Yeah.
Manhunter is the movie. Ryan Cox playing the Hannibal Lecter character. They actually remade it as a sequel slash prequel to Silence of the Lambs, Red Dragon. If anybody's ever seen that with Edward Norton, that is the Manhunter story done as a sequel to this. I like it. It's obviously not as good as Silence of the Lambs, but it's a good movie. But that was Silence of the Lambs. That was the conversation we were having. We are almost a month into the threequel podcast. We have one February episode left. It is next week. A big shift from Silence of the Lambs. I think we're probably going to have to use our earmuff thing. I'm going to almost guarantee it conversing about this film, because next week we're going to do another Valentine's Day classic, Deadpool, from 2016. It just gets into the 5-year mark, so get ready for that. Are you guys slightly more excited to watch Deadpool than you were to watch Buffalo Bill dance for the camera?
I'll just say yes.
Slightly.
Slightly. Good. Good. Okay. Well, I'm glad. All right. That was the third episode of the Threequel podcast for all three of us. I am Ethan Klein, for Brad, for Mike. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next time.